operator. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Zone File Access Advisory Group workshop. My name is Craig Schwartz, and I'm one of the ICANN staff supporting this particular piece of work. We'd like to welcome you to today's work. I'd like to run through a few administrative items before introducing the speakers on today's call, and they'll lead us into a discussion on what we'll be covering today. I do want to remind folks that the call is being recorded and that there'll be an MP3 available of the meeting within the next 24 hours, posted to the ZFA information webpage on ICANN's website. I would like to acknowledge the two advisory group co-chairs, Rod Rasmussen and Vladimir Shadrinov, and also to acknowledge the ICANN staff supporting the work, Dave Piscatello, Mark McFadden, and myself, who are on the call. For the folks that are signed into the Adobe link, I'll be monitoring that, so if you do have a question and would like to speak up, if you could raise your hand in the Adobe room, we'll start a queue and take questions that way. And throughout the presentation today, we encourage folks to ask questions as they arise rather than waiting until the end. We will have a dedicated question and answer session following the presentation, but we do encourage questions throughout the talk today. I'd also like to remind folks that there is currently a public comment forum running on the Zone File Access concept paper, and that comment forum, it's posted that it's supposed to run until 8 of April. It should be 1 April, and I presume, though, we're just going to wind up keeping it open the extra 7 days. I'd also like to just go ahead and acknowledge the folks that are the advisory group folks that are here in the room in Reston. We have Mark McFadden, who's with ICANN. We have Susan Prosser, who's an advisory group member. We have Jonathan Frakes, who's an advisory group member. We have Ching Chow, also a group member, Mikey O'Connor. And then we have a whole bunch of observers sitting here. So with that said, I'd like to turn the session over to Vladimir, who is with you in Nairobi, to kick off the workshop today. So, Vladimir?
Thanks, Craig. I'm glad to see you all here in Nairobi. Good afternoon to you. Good morning or good evening to those of you who are in other time zones. I see here Brian Cute present, Tatiana Kramtsova. I'm not sure if there are other advisory group members in the room. Yeah.
Barry Cobb from the BC.
Hello, Barry. Okay. So in this workshop, we will talk about zone files. First of all, let's talk about what a TLD zone file is, because our initial reach to the various communities indicated that there might be some misunderstanding as to what constitutes a zone file, what it is, and what, most importantly, what it is not. So the zone file is the collection of data that is provisioned to the DNS service of a particular top-level domain. It's generally, it contains a list of all delegated domain names in a TLD and the corresponding authoritative name service for each domain. Besides that, it usually contains glue records. Glue records, that is the IP addresses of the name service, in case they belong to the same TLD as the main domain. DNSSEC information is also usually included in the zone file. Besides, depending on the operational model of the TLD, there may be other resource records included in the zone file. Now, what the zone file is not. The zone file does not contain any information that's related to the domain registration itself, meaning creation date, expiration date, sponsoring registrar, the main status in the shared registry system does not also contain any contact information for registrants. So whoever gets access to the zone file, that does not necessarily mean they are able to contact the registrant. The history of zone file access. Zone files were available since pre-ICANN times. At that time, there was only one registry operator, Network Solutions, and zone files were available via FTP to the signatories of the terms of service. When ICANN came to life, there was still a single GTLD operator, and the zone file access agreement was part of the agreement between ICANN and that registry operator. During 2001 and 2009, 13 new GTLDs were introduced, and the zone file access agreement was copied into these new GTLDs. So the system kind of worked in an environment where there were just a few GTLD operators. Scalability was not a priority when the original system was designed, and while the new GTLDs were being added, the scalability issues became noticeable, but still the community was able to cope with these issues and still they are tolerable. At the moment, GTLD registries are required by their contract with ICANN to provide free of charge zone file access to any party that agrees, signs an agreement with the registry. Access is provided at no charge, and the as I already mentioned, the zone file access agreements are almost identical across all the GTLD registries. Registries are required to post up-to-date information in the zone file at least every 24 hours. The access methods vary, but quite often access is provided through FTP, through user password authentication, without encryption. Some providers do maintain access control lists, meaning that consumers need to provide their IP address from which their requests originate. And these addresses are in the firewall access list. The access is provided free of charge, and as a result, no SLAs, are service level agreements, are applicable usually to the registries. On the screen, you can see the overview of number of zone file access accounts and their recent changes in the recent months over various GTLDs. You can see that the number of people accessing the zone file data varies from dozens to hundreds, with CommonNet being obviously the most active TLD. We also have to know that country code TLDs are generally not under contract with ICANN, and they do not make their zone files available to the public. And that said, we think that if the work of this advisory group proceeds to the point where some improved zone file system may be introduced, we will be happy to accept country code TLDs into that system so that they can benefit from any improvements we may come up. Then I would like to turn the microphone to Rod Rasmussen, the co-chair of this advisory group, who will speak about possible uses of the zone file access. Rod?
Thank you, Vladimir. This is Rod Rasmussen, and thanks, everybody, for the participation. And I'd like to thank our group members, especially for all the work we've been doing. And I think it shows here in what we've put out. So hopefully you can hear me. I do not have control, by the way, Vladimir, of the presentation, so I'll let you know when I'm done with the slides so you can move it forward. Is that okay?
I can do this for you.
Okay, great. So one of the things that we have discussed as part of the working group is uses for the presentation itself. Oh, I see somebody gave me control. Thank you. Uses of the zone file files themselves by different consumers of the data, and got into various reasons people were trying to get in to get that information to better explore what kind of needs there would be in looking at this question around this. So we've got three different major areas we've divided into. The first is intellectual property and trademark protection uses. And as you might imagine from this, people are taking a look at new domains as they're entering the zones as a place for potential trademark violations. It's also a great way to research new trademark registrations that you might want to make and make sure you're not infringing on somebody else's established domain name. And obviously, you can use it for competitive analysis as to what new terms might be being used out there. And you can also, by taking looking at it from the zone level, be able to look for systemic behavior where broad numbers of domains are registered, and perhaps you can tie them through name servers. You can take a look at large numbers of domains taking a mark and containing a mark, and you know. Put together a better case for infringement around that. Let's see if this will work here. Yes. Did that slide change for everybody else?
Yes, it did, Rod. Yes.
Okay, good. All right, good. I have control. So the second area here we were talking about was that we came across or alluded from the people participating in the group was use for e-crime, both in preventing and investigating incidents. So one of the ways you do that is as new or different domains come into the zone, you can look for particular targets that get phished or sent malware attacks against and things like that. Either by brand or by terms. So if you had something like bigbank-account.net, that would make you a suspicious term, for example. And oftentimes, bad guys will grab a bunch of names ahead of time and then dole them out or use them later on. So you can actually find some of these things prior to spamming them. And you can see this in when you're researching different network infrastructures that they'll use. They'll often use the same name servers, for example. And so if you have a bunch of new domains tied to a name server, you can investigate those right away. And then also you can use, as you're looking across different registries, you can see common patterns of abuse there. And another important use of this is for people who like to who run blacklists, they want to be able to whitelist. In other words, instead of making sure something is blocked, they make sure something doesn't get blocked when it's a legitimate domain name. The third area we threw a kind of a big bucket of other uses in businesses and et cetera, This isn't even a comprehensive list. I think there's many ways that people are using zone files beyond this. But there are certainly people who are doing just research into the Internet itself, the extent and reach of it. And you can take a look at that from at the hosting level or various competitive analysis of things that people are doing on the internet. And clearly, there's an area of the marketplace that's using it for evaluating the potential value of investments into domain names, whether that's looking for domains that are going to expire, and, or the history of keeping track of the history of domains, or looking at domain or labels that are registered in second-level domains names registered in one registry, and trying to see if they're available in another one. And there are applications being used for keywords, knowing what trends are in terms, various geographic things, and where you might want to do ad targeting and other types of things where you're looking at enhancing your navigation behavior and things like that. So that covers the usage areas that we'd identified and put up here. Going on to talking about looking at potential issues as we expand the GTLD space with the new GTLD program. We're taking a look at some of the current issues that we've identified with the current program and how those would or would not continue. And those include things like the security around access, kind of a lack of any service levels for provision of the zone files, and that there's, it's fairly suboptimal as far as the way the costs are distributed. And then as we take a look at overall expansion in the zone files, we have, it becomes pretty challenging if the different registries have different processes for creating and executing an agreement to access it. You have different ways already, and we can imagine lots of different ways for actually provisioning the access to get the files from each registry. And customer support and all the things that you have to do in order to take care of problems, change management, things like that, if everybody has a different system for doing it and different expectations for when things get done. We've seen that a bit with the current system already, and as you expand something like this to an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude beyond where we current are, it becomes very you start putting together the numbers, it looks kind of scary. And there's also some concerns about DNSSEC as far as pure size of the zone files themselves as that gets implemented. So I've got a couple of graphs here that we're going to kind of represent the current system. The first one is from the registry point of view. So if you're a registry providing access to dozens or hundreds of different types of consumers, and there's a few labeled here, you have this one-to-many relationship between all of the consumers of data in that registry. And the next slide I have here shows kind of from the consumer point of view, but as a collective, if you will, where you have each consumer has a few registries that they consume data from right now. And those, in today's world, a single consumer has connections to, anywhere from one to a dozen registries. And then that's repeated over and over and over again as a collective marketplace. Now, if you can imagine, I'm going to back up a slide here for a second. In the future, this would be what a consumer's view would look like if you have hundreds of registries out there. So you can imagine that this next slide would have that same kind of massive scale issue there, where you have a marketplace where you've got lots and lots and lots of those data connections. So visually, you can start to see some of the challenges that scaling this up represents. And I'm going to pass it back to Vladimir for the next set of slides here.
Thank you, Rod. So it was acknowledged through the ICANN reach out to the constituency that there are certain issues with the current zone file access system. When the applicant draft applicant guidebook version 2 was published, and when there was a comment period for it after the Sydney meeting, this issue was raised by the community. In the version 3 of the guidebook that was published before the Seoul meeting, there were the DAG contained provisions for supporting the centralized zone file access. We talked about this issue in Seoul, and it was decided that the further consultation with the various stakeholders will be required, and therefore the decision was made to convene an advisory group in order to analyze the issues. So the advisory group was convened in December 2009. The tasks that were before us were as follows. We needed to collect the information to see what's the current status, what's the current users of the zone files, who are the producers, who are the consumers, so on. What the issues are, and if there are indeed any issues with the current zone files access system. We had to come up with one or several solutions on how to improve that system, how to optimize costs for consumers and for producers of data. And we had to summarize our findings in a concept paper, which is currently available on the ICANN's website and which is posted for public comment a couple of weeks ago. The public comment will last until 8th of April. So what are we heading to? Our goal is to develop an improved zone file access system, which provides for scalability, which is secure, and which provides consistency between the various GTLD operators. We think that there are opportunities to improve costs not only for the consumers of data, but also for the providers of data. We think that there are opportunities to make the system more resilient and more prone to abuse. Sorry, you understand what I'm saying, right? And the important aspect is that the new system must not impinge on registries' abilities to innovate, because we already see registries providing various improved services in regards to zone file access, such as, for example, rapid. VeriSign provides some rapid updates.
Vladimir, did we just lose you? Okay, it seems as we did. So if everybody would just sit tight for a moment, we'll wait for Vlad to dial back in and restart.
Okay.
And if folks who are on the line, if you're not speaking, if you could please mute your phones, we'd appreciate it. Thanks. Are you back, Vlad?
It seems I lost the control of the presentation.
Okay, hold on 1 second.
And the advisory group was co-chaired by one representative from the consumer side of the Zone File Access system, which was Rod Rasmussen, the CEO of the security internet security company called Internet Identity, and the second co-chair was myself. My name is Vladimir Shadrunov. I'm a director of policy for Telnik, the registry for .tel TLD. The problem expressed the problem that was before our group was as follows. We acknowledge that consumers have issues with the current system of the zone file access, and the we think that there are possibilities to improve that model that will in the way that will provide scaling it in the environment where there are numbers of parties, both from the consumer and from the producer sides. The problem statement is published on the Zone File Access Group webpage. Then I would like to turn the presentation to Dave Piscatello. Dave?
Thank you, Vlad. Can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the burdens that we perceive for both the consumers of data and the providers of data. The providers of data are the registries, and I'll begin with them. The first is, is obviously a business arrangement issue, and it has to do with managing contractual relationships and agreements between each of the parties that the registry provides access to. And the process is, is largely a paper process in one sense, because you have an application by a party. There has to be a review of that application to determine whether or not the party has an appropriate need. And then once the registry approves that party, there is an ongoing maintenance of that contract, keep the contact information ready to, and accurate, and to essentially make certain that, in some sense, there are no stale contracts, people who, who stop using the service and no longer need to be contractually bound, and the like. The second is an infrastructure burden, and this is maintaining some sort of bulk transfer service for the approved applicants. Typically, this is using file transfer protocol. Within this this burden, you have the maintenance of accounts for each of the applicants, the creation of credentials, a username and a password typically, or some other authentication method perhaps, maintaining security of the connection, meaning providing some assurance that only the authorized users can authenticate and connect to the file server that the registry provides, providing bandwidth and connectivity sufficient to allow multiple parties access to potentially very large files, and providing sufficient bandwidth where those files can be delivered in a reasonable time frame. Obviously, the extreme example of that is the comm zone, which is 90 million domains, is a very, very large file. You can't offer that service using a very, very small bandwidth link. In addition to those burdens, there is an ongoing real-time need to check the service is not under attack by some form of denial of service or some other kind of abuse, for example, scanning, trying to do a brute force password attack, and mitigating, you know, mitigating those kinds of abuses or potential attacks. Lastly, and one that actually has a pronounced effect on, you know, on consumers is change management. If the registry needs to renumber its IPs for the file server or needs to do some other troubleshooting to understand whether routing to the file transfer service is, you know, is correct or some other issue, all that, you know, is something that the registry has to do as a service provider, much like anyone would do if they were running a public file transfer service or a public web. And then lastly, there's customer care. When something goes wrong, the registry does have to have someone to call for the consumers to understand what the problem is, because the data are extremely important for each of the consumers. Looking at it from the zone data consumer perspective, again, you have two relationships. You have one which is contractual, and you have one which is infrastructure. The contractual process here is relatively the same for the data consumer, except that the data consumer has, you know, different contracts that it would possibly sign with, you know, with GTLD registries. Now, they are all pretty much, you know, pro forma, but there are, you know, some nuances that, you know, that some of the registries, you know, might consider. There are some issues that invariably arise when anyone is looking at a contract, and so all of that requires some sort of you know, legal staff to, you know, to process not only the applications but also do all the contractual maintenance on, you know, for each of the data consumers. And here again, you have the FTP client side of the connection for the data consumers. For each of the GTLD registries, the data consumer has to manage the account credentials, has to know the IP addressing and other access controls and other security mechanisms that the individual GTLD registries apply to perform their security due diligence, so to speak, to make certain that the registry service is available. One of the other aspects that is, you know, that is important for the data consumers is that even after they've managed the downloads and they've pulled in all the data, one of the things that most of the data consumers who use data on a large scale will do is aggregate and attempt to normalize the zone data across multiple registries. By normalize, I mean that they will try to grab the data from disparate zone files and try to pull them together into some synthesized format so that they can apply automation to perform whatever analysis on the data is appropriate for their business model. So in some cases, people will go through and only want to look at domain names. In other cases, they'll want to be able to sort and order IP addresses. In other cases, they want to do some correlations and pull it into, you know, some sort of structured database. In each of these cases, there's a fair amount of appreciation needed for any of the individual nuances that exist in a registry's zone data file. In particular, differences in the kinds of records that, you know, that the registry might include in the zone file. And here again, in the change management and problem reporting side of the of just daily maintenance is important for data consumers. When, you know, when one registry changes, the data consumer has to quickly react so that his automation is not interrupted. When a problem occurs with any of the one registries, again, he has to be able to quickly contact the registry and resolve that problem, because his automation or his analysis is dependent in many cases on the availability and existence of zone data from all the registries. The some operational issues that, you know, have a surfaced and have been identified by various parties who are part of the Zone File Access Advisory Group are generic observations. When we look at the security model that exists today for file transfer service, the security model is relatively reminiscent of the way file transfer has been secured for many, many years. In one sense, using username and password and FTP is known to be a relatively higher risk than using some other form of credentials. In some sense, using IP addresses as a form of access control is known to be vulnerable to spoofing. So there are the general conclusion you can make on any file transfer service, not specifically the registries, is that the risk of unauthorized access is higher than desirable. In some cases, if the registries are quite justified in being concerned and appreciating the fact that costs are significant for what, from a business process perspective, is a non-essential, uncompensated function. As I talked on, from both the perspective of the data provider and data consumer side, infrastructure change management is quite challenging. You've got, a matrix of N consumers times M providers, and when you change those, there's a ripple back effect to a very large number of parties on either side. The other aspect that that is desirable, that is not present today, is to understand whether there would be an opportunity to establish some sort of standards or metrics for availability or performance. So having looked at the problem space presented to the advisory group, one of the things that the group thought to consider was, are there models that are different from the model that is used today that might be appropriate or worth study to see if there there is a model that is more suitable for zone file access in an environment where there's potentially larger numbers of providers, new registries, but also possibly larger numbers of consumers. Trying to understand how many more consumers one might have is rather challenging because you don't quite know whether the existence of many, many more registries would create more competition in the various business interests that people have in obtaining zone file access. You can only speculate that criminal activity might rise. You can't say definitively it would rise. Understanding whether you would go from hundreds of consumers in some of the zone files to thousands is not something that's very easy to speculate because this is a rather dramatic change that the community has never seen before. So what we've attempted to do is is go through these four models, and I'll go through them at sort of a relatively high technical level to try to identify the differences among the three, among the four rather. First
Dave,
is what.
Dave, I'm sorry, it's Craig Schwartz. Vladimir, I just want to ensure that we still have the workshop folks with us on the line.
Say again, Craig.
We're still okay. The line to the workshop is still open?
Yep.
Okay, and you can hear us fine.
Yep.
Yeah,
thank you.
Craig, the lines are separate, so, the Adobe Connect is different from the bridge, so we still got that connection.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let me continue. So the first model we call an enhanced bilateral model, and in this particular model, what we attempt to do is consider how to evolve the current system of bilateral agreements between registries and consumers, and then focus on what have been identified as the problem areas. And this effort is largely one of attempting to standardize on elements of the relationship from both the business side, which would be the access application process, management of of the agreements to, you know, and then on the second side.
And we lost Dave.
You lost Dave?
Hello?
Yes, this is Dave.
Dave, we can hear you here in Reston.
No, we can't hear Dave here.
That's odd.
Craig, is Dave on the bridge?
He was a moment ago.
Yeah, the bridge is up because we're talking to you, but we just
right.
can't hear him.
Yeah, maybe Dave just ran into a problem, so let's give him a second.
Can you hear me now? Or?
Yeah, Dave, I can hear you in Reston.
Yes, Dave.
Yeah, you're
Dave,
back, Dave.
Okay, fine.
Thanks.
So let me continue quickly on the enhanced bilateral model. Essentially, what we'll do here is try to understand how to standardize both the business side of the relationship and the infrastructure side of the relationship. So we would look at the problems that have been identified in managing applications and contracts, and as well we would try to come up with some standards and conventions that consumers could rely on in terms of the way file transfer would be supported, even down to things like path and naming conventions for zone files, some sort of standard availability for zone file updates, standard customer support procedures, standard security procedures, and standard change management procedures. And one of the points we'd like to raise here, since this is the first of the four models, is that some aspects of this model could also be combined with some of the subsequent models. A second approach is to sort of look at the ability to create an aggregation point, much in the same way that one puts a switch in a network to try to aggregate many connections onto a single connection. We also do this in enterprise networks today, when we create secure extranets or secure intranets. There's one common access portal through which all the customers or all the employees can authenticate and then gain access to some sort of service behind this security gateway, so to speak. So here, instead of a bilateral model, what we insert is a neutral, independent third party or parties, and what they do is they mediate between the providers and the consumers of data. And the mediation is different depending on the details of the model that I'll talk about in a moment. So some of the things that such a neutral provider could offer is to perform the aggregation on the disparate zone file data composition, provide standard access, provide a point of access control and security, so there would be only one particular way that consumers would need to understand to access all the zone files. So we actually have identified three possible models that could leverage this approach. The centralized zone file access model essentially creates an environment where we allow multiple consumers to access a single point, and that single point essentially provides some form of coordination between the multiple consumers that access that point and the multiple providers that are offering service through that access point. And this allows the treatment of data connections, legal agreements, security management, and policies to be uniform for both parties through that mediary. I'm going to leave the high-level model comparison chart here so that you can take a look at this later, and I'd like to sort of pick up the pace a bit and move on to talking about the individual models. But you could refer back to that, and do a comparison, or we could do that during the question and answer. The first model I'd like to talk about is a repository model. This one involves an independent or a neutral third-party operator who essentially takes on the full burden from the registry, other than the need for the registry to actually provide the zone data to the provider. So the third-party operator would manage the contracts, would collect zone data files from the registry operators, and would provide the security administration, provide zone access to data consumers, do all the troubleshooting, abuse monitoring, and potentially provide some of that normalization that I mentioned earlier on. And what it would do is it would operate according to service level agreements established by the registries and ICANN. The second model differs from that repository model only slightly. This model is very close to what we see quite often in the enterprise world. That's called an SSL VPN, or a Secure Socket Layer Virtual Private Network. Here what you have is that single aggregation point, and it performs all the business aspects and security administration as per the repository model. What it does not do, however, is actually collect and maintain the zone data files of all the registries. Instead, it proxies connections between a data consumer and a registry. So when the consumer actually asks for a zone file, the proxy will say, okay, I know that you have access to this registry because I see you have a contract here, so I'll establish a connection on your behalf to the registry. The registry will then accept that connection and pass the zone data that's been requested back to the proxy, and then the proxy would pass the data along back to the consumer. Again, this model would operate according to service level agreements. So the last model attempts to separate the business element and some of the customer care and what I would call identity management problem from the actual data transfer. And so by clearinghouse here, just to make certain we don't overload the term, what we mean is an independent third-party operator that performs as a centralized point through which the consumer does the application for access to zone files. But it also is a credentialing agency. In some sense, this is kind of like Kerberos, which is an authentication model that's been used by Microsoft and others for many, many years. What you do as a consumer is you go to the clearinghouse, you ask for access to a registry, you complete the contractual agreements, and then you will get credentials for access to that registry. You can then use those credentials to directly connect to one of the back-end registry operators that you've just established a contractual agreement with. So the benefit to the consumer is that it has one place to go to apply, to gather its credentials, to deal with identity-related trouble and management. And the benefit of the registry is that it offloads all that work, and what it can do is focus on a sort of smaller responsibility in one sense of simply maintaining the data connection. And again here, the goal is to be able to operate according to some service level agreement. So I'm going to pass the presentation over to, I believe, Mike O'Connor, and thank you very much.
And before we have Mikey start addressing his slides, we've got a few folks on the line that are having problems. They got disconnected from the bridge and can't get back in. Operator, can you hear me?
Hi there, sir. I can hear you. No one's line is showing us being disconnected.
Well, we've got people in Tokyo and in Toronto, at least those two cities, saying that they are not able to get back into the call. What do you propose I tell them?
Just bear with me for one moment, and I'll check the telephone number that they're dialing for the call, because everybody that's joined this call has remained on the call. No line has disconnected. So I'll speak to you over meeting view, and I'll give you the correct telephone numbers.
Thank you.
Hi, all. This is Mikey O'Connor, another member of the advisory group. And one of the things that we did fairly early on in this group was just start to build what I would consider at this stage a sort of first pass, pretty crude cost model. I think the original question that we were really trying to answer was, are there any cost ramifications to this? Because if it turned out after we'd done a little modeling that there really weren't any cost savings to be had by anybody, that would be important for us to know. On the other hand, if it turned out that there were, in fact, cost savings to be had, that would be useful to know, too. And so we we had a subgroup that worked to build a cost model, and I will attribute all the smart ideas in that model to them and all the dumb ones to me. We started really zeroing in on the cost to consumers because it turns out that most of the cost drivers are really focusing not so much on the actual transfer of data as much as it's on the administration of the accounts. In that middle bullet is sort of saying we're still hard at work on that. You'll note that there are no numbers on this slide, and that's on purpose because it's been my experience. I've spent a lot of time in the financial sector, and once a number goes up on the wall, that number gets sort of branded into people's brains, and our numbers really aren't ready yet. What we've got is a model that works fairly well, but we haven't yet scrubbed the assumptions in the model. We haven't finished building it out. There's a lot yet to do, but we wanted to let you know that it's there, and if you work really hard looking at our preliminary report, you can even find it. And I'm happy to report that Jeff Newman, who was going to beat me about the head and shoulders with his pink fuzzy bunny slippers, has gone to bed, so I don't have to actually defend any numbers today unless somebody else has read that report. In case, I will do my very best, having pulled four all-nighters in a row to defend the numbers. But I would really encourage people to be a little bit relaxed about the numbers that you see in the model right now, and rather know that we're working on it. We're pretty confident that we can scrub that model into something that will be pretty useful for decision-making, but that it's not really quite ready for prime time yet. The final bullet is really repeating the point that I made a minute ago, which is that the big cost drivers don't seem to be in the delivery of data. They really seem to be in the administration of the accounts. And this really gets driven by the assumptions of how many registries we're actually going to have and how many customers we're going to have. If the numbers don't grow much, then the cost justification doesn't get very exciting. If the numbers on either or both sides of that grow a lot, then we start to see some pretty interesting numbers emerge. And I think that's my only slide. Go ahead and advance the slide and we'll see. Want me to do funding strategies or is somebody else doing that? He said, getting ready to make stuff up. Go for it. Oh, no. Matt's here. And he was going to do it, and he's still going to do it. Yay, Matt. Come on up here, Matt. All right. Mark. And it's Mark McFadden coming to the...
Well, thanks, Mikey. What a great introduction. One of the things that you can imagine as the result of a cost model is that you might wonder, given the four models that Dave talked about, excuse me, how you might go about funding a centralized zone file access strategy. And to be honest, the advisory group has talked a little bit about funding models, but has come to no conclusions and really requires quite a bit more discussion. The current environment, of course, is that zone file access in the current format is provided at no charge to the consumer, other than the costs that are associated with bandwidth. The bilateral relationship between the consumer and the provider is one where no money is exchanged. Now, this doesn't prevent, and Vladimir talked about this earlier, this doesn't prevent, of course, registries from innovating and creating new products or services that then they turn around and charge for. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the sort of baseline model for zone file access. Now, the question is in the presence of a large number of new GTLDs, is that a sustainable or even the correct model? That's an open question, something that the advisory group is certainly talking about. And in sort of talking about what kinds of models could be used for funding, several different models have sort of emerged. As an example, a transactional model where you were charged per download or per access of the zone, a subscription model, some sort of tiered approach where you treated certain consumers differently than other consumers. For instance, very large consumers who were downloading the zone file very, very often were treated differently than an organization or a person who needed the zone file just once a month or once a year. And then something that has been popular in the discussions in the advisory group, but again, I stress there are no conclusions that have been drawn, a hybrid of these approaches, actually seeing that the transactional model works very, very well for low-volume zone file access, but it sort of punishes the high-volume zone file access consumer. And so hybrid models are one approach that people have suggested to meet the needs of many different kinds of consumers. I want to stress, and this bottom bullet is very important to us, it's very, very early days in the conversation about funding strategies for zone file access. There's a lot of, I really should stress that the conversation that's taken place so far is very, very preliminary. And even the open question that starts with the second bullet here is still in discussion. And so the Zone File Access Advisory Group will be doing a lot of work in this area in the coming months. Maybe I can have you go to the, I don't know if it takes both of you, but go to the next slide. So let me talk about, that's a nice segue for me. Let me talk a little bit about what's going to happen for the Zone File Access Advisory Group. Vladimir and Rod talked about the public comment period that's currently open on the concept paper. That concept paper public comment period is open, I think, until the 8th of April. And that's relatively easy to find online, modulo some definition of relatively. And the next steps here is really to get the advisory group back together to refine its cost model, to do more work there, especially to incorporate more information from the provider community on zone file access costs, to talk at much more length about the funding model and how that would work. And then those two things taken together will help inform a decision about what a candidate model would look like. And I think that a couple members of the advisory group advised me to do this. I put models and then in parentheses of the letter S here with the idea that it might not be a single model. What you'd like to do is simplify as much as you can, sort of a la Occam's razor, but it might be a situation where certain consumers were better served by one model than another. And so one thing that you can imagine here is that there would be multiple models in operation. On the other hand, multiple models for operation opens the question of consistency, which is one of the goals here that Dave talked about in the early part of the presentation. Clearly, what's intended here is to have some concrete language and specifications laid out in the next version of the Applicant Guidebook. Really, the key thing here is for the advisory group to do some work here in March and in April so that when the next version of the Applicant Guidebook is produced, that in it is at least a fairly comprehensive view of how zone file access should work for the new round of GTLDs. At the bottom of the slide is, and Craig talked about this at the beginning of the call, is the URL for all the zone file access materials. That includes not only a link to the concept paper and a link to the cost model, but also a link to all the notes from meetings and all of the MP3 recordings of the meetings. So again, if you're interested in further details on the work of the advisory group, that URL is actually pretty useful. And I think now what I'll do is I'll turn this back to Vlad to finish up and start with questions and answers.
Thank you very much, Mark. So we already have one question on the chat. Pat Kane asks how there are heavy users when the current agreements allow for once-a-day download. So may I answer that question, Pat? There are users who just download the files occasionally or maybe even once or twice since they signed the agreement. And there are patterns where users do that on a daily basis. Also, there are users who just access a single zone file for a single TLD, and there are, let's say, professional users who download multiple TLDs. So these are the amount of load that different users put on the zone file access system really varies.
Okay, the primary reason I was asking is because Mark, when Mark was talking, I kind of interpreted that as being an ongoing access over the course of the day. And one of the things that I'm looking at from how we update the zone file is it's an expectation that the data be near real time in the zone file access, that there's implications to how the registries manage providing that data. That's why I asked that question.
Great. And let me be clear, because I misled you.
Unintentionally, of course.
Yeah, I did. It was unintentional.
Actually, it might have been intentional.
Not just that.
Okay, but right now the zone files are actually provided very, very often, once every 24 hours. And one of the things that we want to be very careful to preserve is that for other uses where people have near real-time or quasi-real-time, say, five-minute requirements, allow registries to innovate in that space, allow them to create products and services in that space, and not get in the way of that, okay? So don't do anything to interfere with, if registries want to produce that and invest in that kind of service, let them go ahead. But the other kind of zone file access, when you think about, for instance, like in the intellectual property community, probably don't need that immediate real-time sort of access.
Right.
And so what they're looking for is the sort of continued provision, the old-style, I don't want to even call it old-style, but the sort of provision of zone file that we currently have.
Right. And so just in discussions that I've had with security analysts, you know, basically getting a once-a-day download of the zone file, you could actually get criminals come in and exit the zone file and never be discovered, because they may have a short window with which they come in and come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've talked to Rod in the past about, you know, things like this. And so so the real advantage of something like this is going to be for the researchers,
right,
and to your point, not necessarily the trademark people, because you want persistence, and trademark is going to be a more of a persistence issue than the security stuff we're talking about with near zero time detection.
Exactly.
Okay.
Sorry.
Vladimir, we have a question here or a comment from Kathy Kleiman. Kathy, want to step on up?
Hi, all. Kathy Kleiman, new director of policy for PIR. I was wondering if there are any other types of questions we should be asking as we look at these other models. And disclaimer, I'm new to this area. But are there other implications or ramifications of the new models? Specifically, are there some dangers that we should be looking at some of the, when we look at some of these models with the consolidation and with the access, are there any dangers, are there any issues about privacy or other concerns? Thank you.
Uh,
This is Vladimir.
I'll get a shot at answering that if Kathy, certainly, you know, we'll take a look at that. I think we're actually having a conversation on the Zone File Access mail list at the moment that is relevant to your question about privacy. The domain name system is a public query response service. There is usually very little in a TLD zone file that discloses anything in a bulk download that would not be disclosed in a single query. There are some mechanisms that you could use to filter the kinds of information that are accessed through a query response, but generally that's not the case. That the zone files that the registries operate don't have information that is in any way personally identifying. So from that perspective of privacy, I think we're not changing things too much. If you're concerned about the question of the disclosure of who the data consumers are by the third party, or the disclosure of parties in the registry, we would expect that whoever might eventually operate this service as a neutral operator would be someone who would be vetted for good business practices, would practice PCI, would practice all the data protection best practices that are expected of a legitimate business partner. So I don't think that's something we would overlook once we got to the point where we'd have an RFP to outsource this. And certainly today there are lots of security service providers or managed network providers who fall into that category. So I don't think we would kind of spin this off to a brand new organization that has no experience in the field. Did that answer your question?
Sorry, coming back up to the mic. I think that answers it, but let me do a follow-up, which is, are the CCTLDs also part of the process being evaluated here, and do they use centralized zone files, and if not, provide access to the zone files, and if not, why not?
I'll take a shot at that, too, unless someone else would like, So the program is for GTLD registries. If there were a CCTLD registry that would want to participate in the program, I personally don't see that there would be any obstacle other than whatever privacy laws or other governance over the data and the operation of that TLD. Guided the registry and so if someone wants to join the party, so to speak, and they're not obstructed in any way legally, then I imagine that we could entertain having them. There are some countries where there is a I'll make my own interpretation. There is a conflation of perceiving the information in a zone file and concluding it's relatively the same as the information that's available through WHOIS, and essentially saying we don't want to allow bulk access in either case. And we're actually trying to tease that out as an issue among the on the zone file access mailing list. In fact, I'm composing an email right now, on a thread. So the only thing that really prevents the CCTLD from participating is its own business decision and any sort of regulation that the country imposes on it.
Dave, thanks for that response. We've got a couple people in the queue now. We've got Jonathan Frakes standing here. We've got Brian Cute, who I think is in the room with you. Do you have folks in the queue on your end, Vladimir?
Just Brian.
Okay, well, so let's go with Jonathan first, and then we'll go to Brian.
I'll go ahead and let Brian go first.
Wow, thank you, Jonathan. Kathy, to your question, a couple points in addition. In the existing zone file access agreement that registries execute with users, there are provisions under Section 4 which prohibit the users from, among other things, using the data for marketing purposes, obligating them to comply with all applicable laws and regulations governing the use of the data. So those constraints do exist in the existing agreement. And there has been registry sentiment expressed to your point in the sense that if there were a third party that in the repository model, for example, were to have access to all of the zone file data across all of the TLDs, a recognition that that entity would be in a position itself where its use of the data would have to be appropriate and bounded, much as the users would be. So that's one point that's come up in the discussion, and that's in the contract for you to review. And then secondly, a sentiment from the registries that no matter what model is adopted or remains in place going forward, that registries want to have the ability to control access to their zone files. And if there are abusive situations or uses of the data, potentially including the privacy question you raised, that whatever the model is, we want to be able to have quick ability to control and shut down that abusive access.
Right. It looks like you're next in the queue. Do you want to make a comment, Rod? Maybe you're still muted, Rod.
How about this time? Is that better? I have a mute on my my headset as well as my phone, so I was doubly making sure I wasn't making noise. I just wanted to make a quick point on the previous question on the CCTLDs providing access. There are some CCTLDs that provide access. They're typically very small, and it's a direct transfer, zone transfer via DNS. Transfer command, so you can get their zone files, but the larger CCTLDs do not in general provide access, although there have been some talking about doing so trying to enhance security and again in the anti-e-crime area, trying to assist in those efforts, but not on a standardized large scale basis.
Thanks, Rod. I don't see any other hands raised here. Actually, we do. We have Pat Kane coming to the mic, so hold on 1 second.
So I put a couple of questions on chat that had to do with really a consolidated model and how the third-party operator would operate. And one of the questions I would have is around compliance, around the usage items within the agreement today. I know that what VeriSign does when we actually bring in a person for the zone file access agreement, we actually go through the same process that we authenticate people for certificates. And so we go through an authentication process for that. And it's much harder to end up doing compliance on usage of the zone file. It's harder to track. But by authenticating people on the front end, that's a process where I know that there's costs that we incur. But the third party would also have to do that, I think, do that same kind of authentication. But then when you also get to the liability of the accuracy of the data, and one of the things that I struggle with is when somebody else is publishing the data that you provide to them, where does that liability for accuracy fall?
This is Mikey. Let me take a turn. One of the things that we are still working on is sort of the contractual framework of all this. We've got couple of threads going on that. One of the issues that came up fairly early in the conversation was who would the contracts be with? There's still be bilateral contracts, would there, what would the impact of the introduction of a third party be on those? And that one's another part that's not quite baked yet. Yeah, come on back up here.
No, I feel like we're like some dance hall and we're all out doing, right. We're breaking, dancing. Okay. So your suggestion would be that you would still have contract maintenance with the registry and you would just have a single serving up through this third party that would control, would be a benefit to the consumer, not necessarily offloading the work of the registry.
Well, the thought would be that you'd probably get a similar benefit to the registry. So if you imagine sort of today's situation on either end of the transaction, if you're a consumer or a provider, you look out into the world and you see the universe of the other end of the transaction. In this model, on either end of the transaction, you would now look to one place, and then you would have a bunch of choices that you could tick off. And that, and the premise of all this is that by going from looking at many things to looking at one thing, that it'll be easier to manage, cheaper to do, reduce the cost, et cetera, and give you a place to focus on for service level. And, you know, that's the theory. We haven't quite baked it yet. And one of the things that's sort of embedded in all that is, well, how does the contracting work in that situation? One of the things we've concluded is no way are we getting rid of the direct contractual relationship between producer and consumer. That's not on the table
okay.
at all.
Okay.
But facilitating the management of those consumer-producer pairs is what we're after. At 4 in the morning, probably better to do this when we both had a little more sleep.
I'll have a bump.
Anybody else want to get in the queue from Nairobi or on the phone or... Jonathan's coming up.
Let me jump up because I made a point in the chat, and just for the benefit of the folks listening, you know, some of the things that we were looking at, John Sensovey really made a strong point that we want to make sure that this data is accessible to emerging nations and looking at different methods of access. And we talked about, you know, potentially offering like Delta from previous, so that a person could download just the, you know, one main file and then the difference each day so that it would reduce the bandwidth in places where bandwidth is an expense. We looked at different things like what the frequency of these zone files were, the format of them, and just basically things to make this more efficient and streamlined as part of what we're doing. So it's not just aggregating it, things like that. That's it.
This is Vladimir. There are questions on the chat about technical aspects of the zone file access in the future models. We really had some discussions about various improvements in the data protocols, such as P2P networks, BitTorrent, or a number of other options. But I would say this is a task for the next stage of the group work because first of all, we need to find out what's the structure of the system that works best for everyone. And only then we can think what technical solution would be the best here. Do we have any other questions at all?
We don't have any further hands here in the Reston hub. What about you in Nairobi and or folks that have dialed into the bridge?
I don't see anyone.
I think with seeing no additional hands and or questions, on behalf of the Zone File Access Advisor Group, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation today. To remind everyone that the public comment forum on the Zone File Access concept paper runs through 8 April and that we will capture all of the information that was discussed in the chat room online today that might not have been raised on the phone bridge and be sure to address that in the work that we take on going forward. a reminder, too, about the Zone File Access information page that has a copy of all the MP3 recordings of all of the teleconference calls that the groups had, as well as a host of other information, including who the advisory group members are, and a copy of the original concept paper, as well as a public archive of the email list that the group uses to conduct business. So with all of that shared and seeing no further comments, I'd like to thank the advisory group co-chairs and the advisory group members who participated in the call today, and to thank all those who showed up in Nairobi for the workshop and those who dialed in from wherever in the world you are, and to say that we look forward to your continued participation in our work. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.